Are you looking for ways to attract and retain private pay clients? Thrizer is a payment platform for therapists built to help clients automatically tap into their out-of-network benefits and save on therapy up front. Check out our special link, join.thrizer.com/modern therapist, and use the code modernTherapists to activate $2,500 in free payments with Thrizer.
Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY done with you training and done for you SEO options. So there is truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist and use the code modern therapist for a DIY course or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your consult for special offers.
You're listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide, where therapists live, breathe, and practice as human beings. To support you as a whole person and a therapist, here are your hosts, Kurt Widhelm and Katie Vernoy.
Welcome back, Modern Therapists. This is the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. I'm Kurt Widhelm with Katie Vernoy, and occasionally we talk about some of the issues that our clients bring into sessions, things that we might not get really prepared for in our normal therapist trainings and our grad schools. Sometimes these very special topics are very much at the cutting edge of things that we learn about. And to get to the point of things today, we are joined by Therapy Reimagined speaker. All I'm seeing is shaking heads from Katie, our guest. Our guest is Angela Caldwell. She is here to talk to us about self-injury, and it's one of our Therapy Reimagined conference speakers. We're very excited to have her back this year, and she's here to share all of her wisdom and expertise on working with cutting and non-suicidal self-injury. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for having me and for all the puns.
We're so glad to have you. You're a friend of the show for sure. And you did an awesome job at our conference last year. And we're so glad to feature you this year. The first question that we ask all of our guests is, who are you and what are you putting out into the world?
Yeah, I love that you guys asked that question. That is a great reflective, introspective question. So here's my answer. I have changed across the span of my career so far. I think I came in like most therapists. I wanted to be a therapist. I wanted to help people. I wanted to have a specialty. I didn't want to be a generalist. And so my specialization in self-injury was how I started. And that's how I built my reputation. It's how I built my business. It's how most other therapists, my friends, it's how they know me. It's how I get referrals. And it's a population that is always dear to my heart. But I would say over the past 3 years, there has been a shift in what I am interested in putting out into the world. And so I've gone backwards. I think some therapists go from being generalist to specializing. And I feel myself going from specialization to generalized. Most people who know me know that I am absolutely a champion of family systems therapy. And that's become my joy and happiness. And so now, in the past 3 to 5 years or so, now I'm looking at my clientele and there's the percentage changed. So it used to be mostly non-suicidal self-injury, some garden variety family therapy. And now it's mostly garden variety family therapy and some self-injury. It doesn't mean that I don't still love that population, and it doesn't mean I want to talk about it all day long with you guys today. But what I'm putting out in the world is I want to add my voice to the champions of families, the champions of dinner tables. I want to build dinner tables. I want families to get along. I want families to find their way back to each other. There's a small movement. I don't know. You guys tell me what you think. There's a little movement, it feels like, of therapists who are interested in severing family ties because they're identifying family members as being toxic and you have to remove the toxic people from your lives. I want to move against that current. I want to say, let's not remove family members from families. Let's patch families back up and sew them back together. So what did I just say? I think I'm selling dinner tables.
Jumping right into it. When therapists are faced with clients who are engaging in self-injury, What are some of the mistakes that a lot of therapists make early on that if we're going to use this as a learning place, like how do therapists usually approach this in an incorrect way? So that way we can help our listeners not make those same mistakes.
So two mistakes come to mind right off the bat. And the first is in the treatment planning, and the second is in the way of being in the room. So the first mistake I would say is the goal. It is a mistake to make the goal of therapy stop cutting.
Okay.
And then in the way of being, it is a mistake, hold on to your hats and glasses, to take it so seriously. So in the treatment planning side, it's understandable. It's understandable that a therapist, especially somebody who's not as familiar with this, would want to, that seems like a reasonable goal. You know, somebody comes in and says, I'm cutting a lot, which is not usually how it happens. Somebody comes in and what they say is, my mom thinks I should be in therapy, or my boyfriend thinks I should be in therapy, and cutting is a problem, or burning is a problem, or carving is a problem. And so the therapist reasonably thinks, okay, well then let's help you stop cutting or stop carving or whatever it is. Because non-suicidal self-injury is more broadly understood as a form of coping, that's akin to making the goal of treatment stop crying, as opposed to understanding what you're crying about. So in this case, understand what you're cutting about, addressing that, making that the goal of therapy. And then what you do is you render the self-injury unnecessary. In the way of being, again, understandably, a lot of therapists approach this with their own anxiety, and that makes them put a gravity to the topic that exacerbates the problem. And it makes a therapist, it's hard, it's a weird thing for me to say, but the elephant in the room would be the cutting. And I want you to kind of let it be an elephant in the room. I always tell people in my therapy with self-injurers, I'm hardly ever talking about self-injury.
That makes me feel so much better. Because I think it's something where, you know, there's a few things there. The first one is making a goal of not cutting is like,
it's symptom like, reduction.
It's symptom reduction, but it's also removing something without putting something in its place. And I think that's the thing that I find really hard with trying to change coping, whether it's smoking or cutting or drinking or whatever. If there's not a replacement, then you just have a person in pain with no mechanism to soothe themselves. And so to me, I think a lot of times, and I think about this when I was in community mental health, but that notion of like liability being the issue. And so we have to show that we are trying to get them to stop hurting themselves. It's like, okay. And maybe that's what the paperwork says, but like, are you cutting this week? Let me see your arms. Like whatever it is, like it feels so intrusive and overwhelming. And from what you're saying, potentially irrelevant. It's the type of coping strategy. And I'm sure you're going to go into more detail and I'm oversimplifying, but it's the type of coping strategy. That's not the treatment. The treatment is getting to what's there. But the other part is like, don't be so focused on, I mean, they go hand in hand, right? Because if your treatment goal is to do it, is to stop doing it, then you're going to have to check in and talk about it all the time. Whereas if the treatment goal is more around whatever they're bringing, rendering it unnecessary, then of course you can relax into it, which for me, it feels a lot better. So
I love what you just said. if I could record that speech, because the other thing you're up against, I think the greener therapists are concerned about liability. Once you get over that hurdle, the other thing you're up against is parents, because this is a population that's presenting usually around teenagehood. And if not the other teenagehood, early 20s, right? And there's a family member that is understandably very upset about the cutting, very upset about the burning. And they very much want that to be the focus of treatment. So you're up against, you've got an opponent there in a way with a parent or a concerned loved one. And it's that speech that you just gave is what I tell parents is, hey, listen, we can't make that the focus, because if I take that away, I'm taking away the only oar that he or she has in the paddle boat, right? Like then she's going to crash, right? That doesn't assuage them completely. It buys you about a week. So, but if you can give a version of that speech every week, actually, now that I think about it, a lot of my treatment is reassurance with parents.
Which, you know, has that natural, I guess, extension into the family therapy work that you were talking about at the beginning. But I imagine that part of this discussion too is really also differentiating between the non-suicidal self-injury and self-injury that does come with suicide. And I know suicide's being a big focus of a lot of the discussions around mental health right now, and a lot of the trainings focusing on it. It's a topic that we've visited several times here on this show already. How do you go about assessing the differences between suicidal and non-suicidal self-injury?
It's one word. You are looking for intent. So non-suicidal self-injurers lack intent to kill themselves. As a matter of fact, you see the contrary. What you'll hear in your office are stories about how the other night I cut so deep and it really scared me, so I had to wake my mom up. In fact, that's sometimes how they end up in therapy in the first place. One time I burned so bad and it wasn't healing that I actually called 911. Well, listen to what you're hearing in those sessions. What you're hearing is, oh God, I might die. Not, I think it's time for me to die. Right? So and you guys probably have suicide experts that come on here that can walk through a comprehensive suicide assessment. All good therapists know that you should be assessing for suicide with all of your clients all of the time. It's just that you do it in the back of your mind. The relationship between non-suicidal self-injury and suicidal self-injury is, this is such an annoying answer. I hate when people say this, and I'm going to say it, both simple and complex. I told you the simple part just now, the intent. Sometimes my students or my associates will say, but how can you assess for intent? And that's my husband likes to say, there is such thing as a stupid question. Ask what the intent was. I have this thing that I say that it's important for therapists to be able to talk about suicide, to use the word suicide with the same emphasis that we use the word hamburger. We should be able to create a space in the room where it's safe to talk about this. You get to bring all of those thoughts to me. You get to tell me about your ideas, and you're not going to scare me. You can change your mind. You can think that you want to kill yourself one day and not think you want to kill yourself the next day. Okay. So the simple part is intent and ask. How do you assess for intent? You ask, like outright ask. There's a lot of cool stuff that comes with being direct, with coming out and saying, okay, so what was happening there? Were you trying to die? What you do in that magical sentence is build rapport. You establish trust. You show that client you're not afraid to talk about this. You're not going to hold it against them. You want to know all the information. You're not going to freak out. Okay, the complex part. Parents will ask you, and principals and psychiatrists will ask you some version of this question. Is self-injury a gateway drug to suicide, right? So, and it's, you get why they're asking that. This is a scary thing for loved ones to see. And the answer to that is, and I'll tell therapists, it's a trickier thing to talk about with parents and loved ones, of course, but not because it's self-injury, because any emotional distress is a gateway to suicide, right? Because eating disorder can lead to suicide, or substance abuse can lead to suicide. It's not that the action, in fact, that's not even a correct sentence. The eating disorder isn't leading to suicide. The self-injury isn't leading to suicide. All of those are ways to cope with something that is going unresolved. And if that thing continues to be unresolved, then yes, you are looking at a suicide risk. Of course you are. There's a problem in the way that it's being researched, not the researcher's fault, the way that we are consuming the research on it in terms of correlation. And you guys are familiar with the causation versus correlation problem.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Anytime we establish a correlation in the literature, all of us, I'm even guilty of this, all of us want to jump to a causation. Of course we do. We're human beings. We are creatures that want to be able to explain and predict our environments. When you actually do a deep dive into the databases, what you will find is a strong correlation between non-suicidal self-injury and suicide attempts. A, we don't want to mistake that for causation. And B, slow down. Also do a deep dive into the correlation between substance abuse and suicide attempt, divorce and suicide attempt, grief and suicide attempt, right? The problem with that discussion is the way that we take it in, not so much how it's being researched, right? The researcher's doing a great job, but the way that we're taking it in is, oh, if she's cutting, she's probably going to commit suicide. Okay, that's a problematic statement for all the reasons I just described. The reason I can forgive people for making that mistake is because of what it is. Unlike an eating disorder, unlike general depression, unlike a divorce, self-injury, a lot of times, in fact, most of the times, happens on the arm, usually nearby the wrist, and usually with some kind of blade. So it sure looks a lot like what we see in suicide. So I can forgive and understand why people get freaked out about that idea. That was a big speech. Sorry.
Thrizer is a payment platform designed for out-of-network therapy. As a therapist, you would use Thrizer to charge clients for sessions and collect your full rate upfront. From the client's perspective, Thrizer links to their health plan, so insurance claims are automatically submitted for them upon every charge. From there, Thrizer manages the claims end-to-end so that your clients don't have to worry about manually submitting super bills or getting on calls with insurance. The best part? Thrizer allows clients to only pay their co-insurance portion for sessions, while Thrizer covers the rest of your fee and waits for reimbursement on their behalf.
They also offer you an instant benefits calculator for free, allowing you to provide upfront transparency to prospective clients on their out-of-network coverage. Therapists only pay a standard 3% credit card processing fee per session with no additional fees. Visit join.thrizer.com/modern therapist to get started and use our promo code Modern Therapists to receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Well, I was thinking about kind of this idea of correlation versus causation. And I think there's a lot of folks who tell themselves a story. And so one of the stories I think I've told myself in the past is that sometimes self-injury is coping and sometimes it's practicing. And I think that story of it being practicing, I think is what kind of flows in with this causation. How far off am I? I guess is the question from your understanding of it.
So we've got a couple of researchers that are, taking the lead on that. That's the question I think they are trying to answer, and they don't have an answer for that. The most important researcher we have here is a guy named Matthew Nock. And if you look at what he's been writing, he's trying to answer that question. So the bad news, Katie, is we don't know. I will say that anecdotally, and so I'm looking at my years of practice, and how many is that? My very first case was my very first, like hour number one of 3,000 hours was self-injury. So I've been doing this for 15 or 16 years. I have not seen practice. I have seen coping, and I have seen cry for help. That's what I've seen there. It's not to say that I've never seen suicidal ideation, even suicidal gesture in my office. It's just that I'm cautious to link self-injury with suicide so in such a short, abrupt way.
You talked about the need to address what's going on underneath the self-harm as being the key to treatment here. And in looking at that, what are kind of some of the times that we see self-harm as an expression of a deeper symptomology? Like, get us to the nuts and bolts of like, why do people,
right, why are they doing it?
If it's not suicide, why is it?
Yeah. Okay. So my favorite question, it's funny. I wanted to give this talk. I submitted an abstract to this conference once and it got turned down because it wasn't what they were looking. Oh, wait a minute. That was you guys. It wasn't what they were looking for at the time, but I actually wanted to give, and someday somebody will let me give a talk about one of the causations. Is that a word? One of the causes. I wanted to give a talk entitled Rage in the Family, the Problem with Really, Really, Really Nice Families. So.
wait, we turned that down? That sounds amazing.
Well, gee, thanks, Katie. I'm going to send it to you next time.
Yeah, send it to me.
This is going to seem overly simplified, and I guess I'm sorry for that. I want you to go with me down an oversimplified path. There are two things that are at the core of non-suicidal self-injury, and that is we talk about that in terms of profiles. There's two profiles. One profile we call the rage-based profile, and the other one we call the peer-based profile. We used to call it the attention-seeking, and that was frowned upon. We don't want to use that. Therapist punched me in the face for using that term, so we changed it to peer-based non-suicidal self-injury. So in the first case, let's do the second one. It's easier. In the second case, the peer-based one, if you have ever heard, there's this software called Facebook, and there's another one called Instagram. I imagine you're familiar.
Yeah, we're familiar.
and there's like YouTube InstaTalk, you know, there's like whatever.
Yeah, there's so, yeah, the tickety-tockities.
I'm new to the World Wide Web, so... Anyway, okay, come on. Any therapist in the world is aware that we have an issue on social media with kids, and then the older kids, right? The 20s, mid-20s. There is an epidemic in my little corner of the field, and there has been for years now, of us getting calls from parents. My kids started cutting, or a best friend found out and called the principal, and the principals sending them to us because they heard that their friend was cutting over Instagram or Facebook. And what's happening is they're taking pictures of their cuts or their burns or the words that they carved into their arm, and they're posting them, they're broadcasting them on social media. Okay, now this is different from when we grew up, us geezers, right? Because it was an unknown idea. It was nobody knows what the prevalence was when we were, when we were coming up. It was certainly more surprising to people because there wasn't some avenue to be able to broadcast it to everybody. So when I first started this specialization, check this out. Most of the people, when I said, "How did you learn about this? How did you start this?" And most of them, it was an accident. So a great example of that is I had somebody who was telling me the story of the very first time she cut herself accidentally, and she was doing dishes and her mother was berating her and screaming these awful things in a drunken rage at her. And she was getting this big headache and she was having a panic attack, and the dish that she was washing broke and it cut her hand, and her panic disappeared and her headache disappeared. And that's how she discovered self-injury. So it was stories like that that I was hearing in the early days. And now the stories you hear, I saw it on Instagram. I saw it on Facebook, right? Self-injury has taken on a little bit of a social currency, because now, you guys have to check me on that. Did we do this? Maybe did all generations do this? I'm going to say now, and then you can correct me. There's a contest going on to be the most fucked up. Oh, sorry. <There's>,
You can cuss. It's the internet.
Sorry, Mom. Okay. There's a beauty pageant, but it's not a beauty pageant. It's like a mental illness pageant going on right now, and it's been going on for 10 years. And they're one-upping each other in trying to be the most mentally ill. About 3 years ago, we found out there's a new one, because for a while they were all cutting and then out-cutting themselves. Now, do you know that now they're all hearing voices? Now they're all psychotic. Now they're out psychoticing each other. But it really is things like someone will cut their arms and put a picture of it on Instagram, and then it starts a whole thread. That now someone else cut both of their arms. Well, I cut my legs. Well, and it's like a contest. Okay, so the treatment plan for that: roll your eyes, don't discuss it, let them do it. Those are the cutters that are going to do it like 3 or 4 times and give up on it. And assess to see if there's actually a real problem that you can help with. Like, is there a family issue? Is there depression, anxiety? Is there something else I can actually treat here? I'm going to say on your podcast, don't even treat it. It's going to go away after the fourth time. Ignore it. Leave it alone. Okay.
You can direct those legal inquiries to Angela.
Ask my husband. We can have another podcast where we talk about how mad Ben is at me for the things that I say in public.
I would say that.
Okay, so the harder one. The harder one is the rage-based. When we discuss rage, we have to talk about the difference between rage and anger. There's a misunderstanding in our culture, not all cultures, but in ours, we have a misunderstanding that rage is simply anger with the volume turned all the way up, rather than understanding that rage is actually a neurochemically different emotion. It's a different secretion in our brains. Rage is limbic as opposed to anger, which is cortical. And that's a fancy way of saying anger, you're still rational. If you think about when you become angry with someone, I joke with my clients about this. Have you ever noticed there's a gift that anger brings? Anger brings the gift of clarity. All of a sudden, if things were hazy before, now you know exactly who fucked you, when they did it, and what you need them to do right now, right? And yes. I've I'm a new parent. My kids are 3 and 4, and I'm very in touch with how rational and cortical anger can be, because all of a sudden you are gesticulating very clearly. You are enunciating, put that down, right? It's like all of a sudden the clouds have cleared. You can see exactly what's happening. I would make an argument that anger is actually quite rational. You can be in a debate. Anger fuels Black Lives Matter and the civil rights movement and feminism, right? Anger is very clear and very rational and very logical. Rage is being cut off on the 405, right? Rage is animalistic, limbic. The blood vessels and heart kind of feels the same in those two emotions, but the brain functioning and the urge is different. The urge in anger is pro-social, is to approach. Right? And the urge in rage is to destroy, tear apart, punch a hole in the wall. It's destructive, right? Okay. Self-injury is rage. Self-injury is destructive. Self-injury is the result. Believe it or not, it's the same emotion in a self-injury, in a not peer-based, in a rage-based episode. The emotion happening there is the same emotion that we know from being cut off on the 405. It's this animalistic, I can't believe it comes from a place of injustice, of feeling completely invisible, completely unheard. And it occurs because in a given situation, your anger is not useful to you. So go back to my freeway example. If you're on the freeway in your car and somebody cuts you off, this is not a time that your anger would be useful to you. You can't say, hey, listen, I was here first. You need to get behind me so that the other guy has an opportunity to say, oh, you know what? I'm sorry about that. Right? It's not useful. Well, when your brain, your cortex is aware that you cannot use the chemicals that it just secreted for you in anger, it's going to lose its mind. And that's a whole nother podcast episode of what's going on there, but it's going to lose its mind and it's going to start seeking. So the research that we have for this argument that I'm making argues that rage comes with a stimulus seeking drive. I want you to think about how other people might seek stimulus. Other people might, if you happen to be, I don't know, someone like Angela Caldwell, you might be punching things like your steering wheel or throwing your iPhone against the wall and having to pay another $600 for a replacement. But things like that, like when you think about stimulus, like banging your fist on the desk, if you think about when you have those moments of rage, those are, you're seeking destruction. Imagine what happens if you have that natural human emotion that we all have, everybody has it, but you're being raised in a really, really, really nice family. A really, really nice family whose governing rule, principle, cardinal rule is thou shalt not burden another human being. Well, we have a problem now, right?
Yes.
Because if I punch something, it's going to burden another human being. If I put a hole in the wall, somebody's going to have to buy some drywall or some plaster, right? If I break my phone, someone's going to have to buy a phone. I can't break my mom's dish. Those are her special dishes. I can't go outside and scream. It'll upset the neighbors. If you take away all of the places to vent, or I should say to seek and obtain tactile stimulus, you're leaving someone with only one possible option, and that's their own body. It's tricky because when they do that, when they go after their own body, they're able to have the serotonin secretion afterwards that, yes, admit it, we all have when we punch the steering. I mean, your hand hurts, but you feel better, right?
Yeah.
They feel better. They're all going to tell you after they cut, they feel better. So they have that, but they also have been able to do it. They've been able to vent the rage and to feel better without breaking any rules, without upsetting anybody, without causing a burden to anybody else. So when they're discovered and they go to therapy, they are mortified. It's the last place they want to be because the whole point was to cut on my own body so that it doesn't cause a burden to anybody else. And all they'll talk to you about in those first two or three sessions is how much money this is costing their mom and how they really don't want, they're really fine. And I have clients all the time telling me that they really should give their space up to somebody who really needs therapy. They're insisting that they don't need this. They're insisting that they are, I make a joke, it's maybe not a nice joke, the F word of cutters, that they are fine. They are absolutely fine.
Simplified SEO Consulting's team of mental health professionals genuinely want to help you attract more of your ideal clients with a proven on-page SEO process using the strategies that are most effective for therapist websites. They know SEO is an investment, which is why it is so important to find someone who aligns with your values and understands the importance of building your private practice in a meaningful way. Simplified SEO Consulting hopes to be that team for you and your practice.
The expert team would love to talk with you during a free consultation to figure out the best fit for your SEO journey. Simplified SEO Consulting has DIY, done with you training, and done for you SEO options. So there's truly something to fit every practice owner's SEO needs. Be sure to ask if their innovative content network is a good fit for your website. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off a DIY SEO course with code MODERNTHERAPIST or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off your done-for-you SEO program onboarding this spring.
Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist.
I know when I was first getting trained, so the very popular idea was, you know, around this attention or this peer seeking sort of cutting that, oh, these people need the attention that comes along with, let's send them to groups. You laugh. I know from my experience of working with a ton of teenagers, this is a bad idea. From your perspective, why doesn't group therapy work for teens engaging in self-harm?
I don't have the right to have my own perspective. I have my own experience with it. It's Barrett Walsh, who is the king of something called the contagion factor. And then I'm going to ask everybody who encounters this to do a deep dive into the research on something called co-rumination. This is a fascinating corner of literature that examines adolescent relationships, particularly female-female relationships, and how, yes, it increases bonding, but in females, sometimes it increases depression because of this thing called co-rumination. Come on, Katie. You know what I'm talking about.
It's like this visceral thing of like, oh my gosh.
Right?
Those friends that you're just like,
Right. And I was a pretty emo kid. Like I definitely remember sitting with my other emo girlfriend and sitting and talking about how bad life is. And then she talked about how bad life was. And so I talked about how bad life was. And we just got deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and affected mood, affected energy level, affected my outlook and my attitude, you know? So, okay. So Kurt, that's one part of it is co-rumination, which is a fascinating part of our field. And then, like I said, Barrett Walsh, he's a PhD who's been in the self-injury field for, I think, decades before I showed up. And he's got a focus in his research on something called contagion factor. And that is the, probably what you see. It's what most of us see when you put teenagers in a group together. They one up each other. They cut harder. They cut deeper than the last one. And you get an epidemic in a matter of days.
But I think that there's also, when you misidentify a person who starts from that rage perspective, the bearer of the family secrets as being somebody who needs the attention end of it, is now you're throwing them into this very mortifying situation of, I didn't want attention from one person. Now I'm supposed to have the attention of eight.
Yeah. Right. I feel like there should be a like the opposite of a pet team. Like there should be a team that like removes you from those, from like the psych wards, you know, like get her out of there.
So those are the things that don't work. Like we don't want to do group therapy. We don't want to focus on it. We want to make sure that we understand that it's not the goal for treatment to get rid of non-suicidal self-injury. What does effective treatment actually look like? We're running short on time. I want to get to the very practical. This is the survival guide for therapists portion. Like, what should therapists do that's effective treatment?
All right, guys, here it is. It's easy. Family therapy. Just do it. And can I get mad on your podcast?
Yes, you can get very mad.
I am so sick of the question. Okay, what if you don't have access to the family? Oh my God, you have access to the family. Unless they are in the ground, you have access to the family. Therapists are so scared of that the family's going to say no. I got news for you. All families say no. Do you want to go to family therapy, Katie? Do you want to go to family therapy? Nobody wants
no,
to go to family
really.
Therapy.
No.
Wake up. There is no such thing as the family that goes, you know what? We have a funky family dance and we all need to change, Angela. So tell us how to do it. There's no such thing, guys. Therapist, stop asking me that question. What if I don't have access to the family? You have access to the family. All right. Okay. I feel better now. See, that was rage. See
how I did there we go. And bang. No, I think it was anger because you seemed very rational.
Damn it. You're right. That was, yep, that was anger. If you ignored me, I would start punching the computer. That would be rage.
That would be rage.
Okay. Family therapy. What kind of family therapy doesn't matter. I happen to practice strategic and structural. You can do experiential. You can do Bowen. The type of family therapy doesn't matter. As long as your treatment goal is to rewrite the family constitution around anger and anger expression. What family therapy looks like with these kinds of family is more like assertiveness training. This is a family that engages in what we call careful talk. So the sessions feel very stifled and very stilted. The family members won't speak directly, or they'll carefully dance around what they're trying to say. It's the opposite of what you guys know about me. They're very indirect in their communications. So your family therapy treatment plan is designed around relaxing fears that you're going to hurt people's feelings. Help them realize, of course, you're going to hurt people's feelings. This is a family. I don't know how to be in a family without hurting my family members' feelings, right? But that's okay. You can do that. For me, in structural family therapy, that is unbalancing and enactment after enactment after enactment. To help them rehearse that, to go ahead and get your feelings hurt and watch how easy this is to repair. I was saying before, it looks a lot like assertiveness training. This, I think, it becomes a little bit of a fine art, because you can tell someone to be assertive. That's not therapy. They can read that in a book. You can model assertiveness. Okay, moving a little bit more toward therapy, but that's you being assertive. It's one thing for them to watch a therapist do it, right? Yeah. It's another thing to actually get them to be assertive. All right, so here it comes. You provoke a fight. You provoke a fight in the family. And you do it session after session after session. And you unbalance and unbalance and unbalance. And what happens with all humans, if you make them mad enough, they're going to shout. They're going to say what they're actually thinking and feeling. They're going to shout at you first because you're safe. They don't want to upset their family members. They have to get in the car in an hour with that family member. They're going to shout at you first. You ready? Shout back. Have an argument with them. Have an argument with them and let them see. And as you're having the argument, it's almost like kind of having two games on at the same time. Have the argument with them and simultaneously say, hey, we're having an argument. I still like you. Keep going, right? And like reassure them that this argument is not going to break our relationship. And then session after session, provoke fights so that they have arguments with each other and conduct the repair in session. Show them that that fight was not detrimental to their relationship. In fact, highlight the places, and it has to be genuine, don't make shit up, right? Highlight the places where that fight actually made them understand each other better, and they're probably going to like each other better now. It's actually going to bring them closer. It's actually going to increase their bonding. That's it. It's called fight therapy. It's called Fight Club.
Thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom with us today. Where can people find out more about you and your practice?
Okay, Kurt, I knew you were going to ask me that. You've caught me at a funny transition. It's an exciting transition. So everybody can find me at my website, which is selfinjuryinstitute.com. And my phone number and email is on there. We are just about, I don't know when you're going to air the podcast, but in like 2 weeks, we are launching the new website, which is the CaldwellFamilyInstitute.com. So that's us moving kind of from a specific self-injury world to broader family coaching.
And we will include links to that in our show notes. You can find those at our website, mtsgpodcast.com. Also check out the conference website, therapyreimaginedconference.com. Angela is one of our fabulous speakers. She's going to be bringing all of this energy and entertainment and information to us. It's a virtual conference, September 24th, 25th, and 26th. I am super excited for Angela's presentation. Our friends over at Simple Practice are helping us put this on, taking care of CEs, and check out the website for all of the information around that. And until next time, I'm Kurt Woodhelm with Katie Verdoy and Angela Caldwell.
Thank you for listening to the Modern Therapist Survival Guide. Learn more about who we are and what we do at mtsgpodcast.com. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our episodes.
Remember to check out Thrizer. They are passionate about making out-of-network therapy work for everyone. Clients save upfront on therapy while therapists earn their full rate. Get started in minutes on join.thrizer.com/modern therapist and use the promo code Modern Therapists and receive $2,500 in waived fees for your sessions.
Don't forget, we have some special offers from our partner, Simplified SEO Consulting. Get 20% off a DIY SEO course with the code Modern Therapist, or mention the Modern Therapist Survival Guide podcast during your free consultation for $100 off of your onboarding to the Done For You SEO program. Check them out at simplifiedseoconsulting.com/modern therapist.